The appellate division also erred, and that and the panel erred below because the by finding that the high-profile cases were relevant by intertwining the two Jeter's state of mind at the scene and in his dialogue to the media. By conflating those two situations, it confused how the prejudice was attributed, or the prejudice attributed to each of those situations, which is different, affected Trinidad. The second issue, if I have, if time allows me, relates to the internal affairs investigation. The police officers, non-expert or lay testimony that Trinidad's conduct appeared criminal. And then why, in spite of the failure to object, that was capable of producing an unjust result. To jump in to the first argument, the trial court did not undertake a Rule 403 analysis to determine whether the high-profile police brutality cases prejudiced Trinidad. The prejudice to Trinidad should be weighed in relation to the reasons for those references. The relevance of the high-profile cases to Jeter's state of mind as to the dialogue with the media did not relate in any way to Jeter's fear of police at the scene. Rather, it related to Jeter's belief that he was a victim of police brutality like the high-profile cases of Diallo and King and Bell and the Fruitvale Station incident. Jeter said, "I can testify that I am a victim of that." He went on and said, "I wanted everybody to understand that I've been through some things that I shouldn't have gone through." In terms of a state of mind exception, those statements were a statement of a belief that he intended to prove a fact that he remembered. They were prejudicial because he compared those high-profile cases with his own. He based his belief that he was a victim to show what happened at the scene. By comparing himself to those victims, he compared Trinidad to a bad police officer. In addition, those statements were unsolicited and actually unexpected by the state.
Can I stop you for a second?
You can.
As I understand your opening statement, you indicated that the judge should have had done held a 403 hearing determination when the door was opened. Is it your position that whenever an improper comment is made, either through a question, elicited through a question, or just blurted out by a witness, so that the door is open because the comment is so improper that it will affect the jury, that in order to correct it, the judge has to determine whether the responding comment does not violate 403? Are you suggesting
yes,
that once?
I believe the answer is yes.
Okay. So what happens when you believe it's a problem with 403? What can the judge resort to make sure that the jury is not swayed by the initial improper comment brought on by the actions of counsel or the witness? How do you resolve that if you have to do a 403 analysis in order to employ the open the door doctrine? How do you resolve that as a judge?
I believe what the court should have done in this particular instance He needed the important in the opening the door doctrine is that there must be a
Something improper has come before the jury, either through a question by counsel, or a response to that question by the witness, or something blurted out by the witness. So now the jury has been affected by the improper comment. The judge usually will allow the other side to bring in evidence to counteract that. And if you're suggesting that evidence must be first weighed under 403, if it doesn't pass muster under 403, what does the judge do? Just allow the improper comment to go on?
I think what needs to be done first, if the trial judge looks at the matter as opening the door, I think under that doctrine, there has to be some kind of attempt by the objection to the state's case in chief or testimony to gain some kind of unfair advantage. And I think that
it doesn't have to be intentional. It doesn't have to be intentional.
That's true. But it was to try to gain some kind of unfair advantage. The court here, I believe, erred in making failing to make a determination under the opening the door doctrine in three ways. One, I don't think it did find.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, but you're assuming there that the doctrine shouldn't have been applied.
Okay.
But in a case where it's clear that the doctrine should be applied, how does your analysis play a part in that?
Well, if it should be applied,
then
403 still applies. Absolutely. Under the opening the door doctrine, the analysis under 403 does apply.
If the response to the open the door doctrine does not fall within 403, so it would be inadmissible, does the initial improper comment remain before the jury with no correction, no evidence to show that it's wrong?
Absolutely, a 403 analysis does apply to opening the door. That's my understanding. But in addition, I do believe a limiting instruction is important to resolve the issue.
So the judge gave a limiting instruction here.
He did.
Are you satisfied with it?
No.
Why not?
Again, because all it did was, all that limiting instruction, it was very short. And really all it said was the state of mind should be either, if you believe it's relevant, should be taken into effect or not taken into effect.
Is it relevant?
That was
the first objection that was made to this statement when it first came out, and then we moved on to the state of mind exception or whatever the court was coming up with. But relevance was never really fully addressed by the trial court, was it?
No, it was not.
Wasn't it conceded by defense counsel?
Your Honor. I don't believe it was conceded.
May I read some passages?
Sure.
Because I'd like you to comment on whether...
Absolutely.
You've raised some thoughtful arguments about error, and I'm wondering if the error was invited. After the reference to Rodney King and Sean Bells, the court says, I would not be averse to putting the jury in the room. Maybe there should at least be a limit on how far Mr. Jeter should be able to go. I'd be open to that. Does anybody think it would be appropriate to tell Mr. Jeter how far into these areas he can go? Defense counsel. I don't know how you can restrict him if that's his state of mind. Why isn't this invited error?
The concern is, the concern at least that I have, I think what the trial attorneys, Trinidad's trial attorney was concerned about was the inflammatory nature, and that's what he, of those references, that's what he concentrated on.
Trinidad's attorney blew it.
Yeah.
Because Jeter's state of mind was not at issue. The defendant's state of mind, whatever Jeter was thinking in the car, had nothing to do with whether or not the police officer purposely or knowingly assaulted Jeter or whether or not he happened to tamper with evidence. And the defense attorneys, number one, were not concentrating on that, and neither was the trial judge. In fact, the trial judge's limiting instruction was enhancing the prejudice by suggesting to the jury that there was a permissible basis for considering Jeter's state of mind. No?
Correct. And not saying what was prohibited about that, any type of state
Peter's
of mind.
Was Peter's state of mind in the car at issue?
No, was not. And it particularly was not an issue as to the media question.
So you have a plain error argument going for you because the chief just cited to you, okay, your predecessor, suggesting that, oh, yeah, this limiting instruction for state of mind is going to really handle the issue. No,
I agree, Your Honor.
I still didn't hear your answer to why this is not invited error.
I think what I was saying, Your Honor, to at least try to answer your question was, the trial attorney was not concentrating on relevance. What the trial attorney was concentrating on was the inflammatory nature of the comments made during the media question.
Well, unfortunately, the judge first suggested the limiting instruction, and the attorney sort of went along with it. I don't know whether or not that's inviting or that's just error on his part and
that's
the trial court's part.
That is what happened, correct.
So let's look at the sequence. It's page 37 of the transcript. It's your predecessor counsel who lays out in six lines what the limiting instruction should say, and then the judge pretty much follows that outline. Not invited error?
No, I think the case law says that. I mean, I know if you want to call it a negotiated limiting instruction, okay, but I think the problem with the limiting
there's plain error in that include invited error, and I'm asking that as mm-hmm. a question because the chief is directing you to comments that are made by defense counsel that are suggesting that what is okay, you're saying is not okay.
I think that the plain error involved in the limiting instruction.
Let me ask you this question. Assuming that it's invited or whatever, plain error invited, if the inclusion of all this highly sensational, prejudicial, inflammatory information has the capacity to deny your client a fair trial, what do we do with the fact that maybe the defense attorney erred and maybe the trial court erred? Go ahead.
I mean, I believe what we have to look at is that the trial court, it is the trial court's responsibility to, as the gatekeeper, to make sure that those errors do not occur. And I think that's where at least the trial court erred. Whether the defense attorney erred may be, another issue. But I think what we have to look at as to
but
Trinidad.
The court can't anticipate what counsel is going to say. There's no script. You're an attorney. You ask questions. The trial judge doesn't know where you're going, what you're going to ask, what you're thinking. So the court could stop if the court knew ahead of time, but this is not that situation. That came out as a question. At that point, what do you do?
Open. Well, one of the problems with this particular scenario was that Jeter's references were not only unsolicited but unexpected. I mean, I think
exactly. So how can the court anticipate that and keep it out of the record? The court has to remedy it in some way, which is
correct.
By the opening the door doctrine.
Well, this was
the
state's witness. This was the state's witness. So you're saying it was unanticipated, maybe for defense counsel, but I would assume that the state knew what their witness was going to testify to.
I don't know if that's accurate, Your Honor. I mean,
why?
I think the record looks at it like, I think the state's attorney actually even said that we didn't know they were going to say that, but then, used it when when he did. I mean, I know he referred to it one time. The first time he referred to it was...
Each time he referred to it, he embellished on it.
He did.
And it led up to the third statement where
Correct.
He goes beyond simply referencing those cases and saying, that's why I was scared at the
Correct.
Scene. He says, I was a victim of that, as
Right.
if he is telling the jury, here's my own police brutality case.
Right. I'm comparing myself to them.
Right.
Yeah. And by doing that, he also compared Trinidad to those bad cops.
But there was no objection even at that third instance.
No, actually, no. What happened, I believe what happened was after the second instance.
I'm looking at the transcript.
After the second instance, there was an objection.
Right.
And a rule.
And the judge puts into the box the fact that relevance is here, I find it, and moves on to this idea that a limiting instruction that presumes relevance can handle this situation.
Correct.
And then notwithstanding that, the witness goes beyond even the purpose to which this limiting instruction is addressing.
Well, he embellishes, I think. I think that was his intent. And I don't believe that the state... And this is I don't believe the state knew that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think that was, it was a diatribe, and he just mm-hmm. tried to, I think Jeter tried to just embellish why he believed he compared himself to those other situations.
But then the question comes back to the one Justice Albin has raised first in this case, which is, you know, why are we even considering Mr. Jeter's state of mind? This was the officer who was on trial, not Mr. Jeter, and it's not a 1983 action, and it's not a Monell issue.
But, I mean, the problem is, yes, I agree with that, but the problem is that the trial judge did say it was a state of mind, and the appellate court also said that.
But
so
it's
now
counsel,
that was...
But it's counsel's obligation to make the record.
Well, I believe that. I mean, I don't think that counsel, I think counsel did object, and I don't think he can continually object and object and object to something that was the same and merely an embellishment.
I think your co-counsel was more on the ball with the objections here. What I find interesting, I'm looking at the transcript of October 15, 2015, page 55 and 56, when your co-counsel objects to the first Amado Diallo's stuff. The prosecutor seems to indicate that this is a real problem. I'm going to quote from the top of 56. I can certainly understand the inflammatory aspect. There's not where I was going. I was just asking him why he didn't get out of the car, why he was throwing up his hands. It stops there. It seems that the prosecutor understands the appropriate limitations. It's then where the court says, well, there's a question here, what was in the man's state of mind? It's the court that is now pressing this state of mind. Not even the prosecutor was going there until the judge interjected that into the case. Go ahead.
I do think that's accurate, and I think that was what I was referring to when it was the state didn't really understand or push that argument. But I think more important is that those are two different scenarios, and we have to look at it two different ways. And one of the problems that I have with the appellate division's opinion is that the appellate division did not look at those two scenarios, did not look at what happened, the reasons for why he said what he did about what happened at the scene, and why he decided to have a dialogue with the media. Those are two different reasons, and the prejudice caused by those two situations are also different. Mm-hmm. And I think the prejudice is more prevalent under the situation where he tried to compare himself and Trinidad to those high-profile cases.
Do you concede that you're going to have, that in terms of standard of review, you're stuck with plain error?
I do not concede that, Your Honor.
There's no objection to the limiting charge.
There was no objection to the limiting
charge. The limiting charge is telling the jury that it's permissible to consider Rodney King, Amadou Diallo, Sean Bell, and all the rest for state of mind. They're permitted to go back to the jury room and discuss all those highly sensational inflammatory cases.
I do not disagree that there was no objection to the limiting charge. I do think that he did object, the trial attorney did object to the references to those cases. Then it was resolved by especially references to those cases in with respect to the media question, and then let the judge do the limiting charge the way he wanted to.
Did defense counsel ever actually say that Mr. Jeter's state of mind is irrelevant? He said the issue, he thought the issue was irrelevant, and then the judge brought up his state of mind, and defense counsel let it go. If it's state of mind, then I guess it comes in.
I alluded to this earlier, if I did not state it specifically. I don't think that the attorney was as concerned with relevance as he was with the inflammatory nature of it, how it prejudiced Trinidad.
But he didn't make that argument. He never even said, because that was the basis on which the court was considering it, Jeter's state of mind. When that came up, it was never raised to begin with that his state of mind is irrelevant. When the court brought it up, I think this is what the chief was saying, he never came back and said, his state of mind is irrelevant. That doesn't come in. Nobody ever said that.
No, what he did say was, those references, I can agree that they did not argue over, I don't think he concentrated on the relevance. I think what he said was, the attorney said was, these references are inflammatory. He did say that. So he's looking, the attorney skipped the issue under Rule 403 as to relevance. What he went straight to is how these references prejudiced him.
He seemed to acknowledge that if it goes to Jeter's state of mind, then I don't know how I keep it out. We don't need a conference to discuss that. I don't know how it stays out. Isn't that exactly what the chief was hitting at?
Well, no, but I think that something happened in between that statement and the judge made a ruling. He argued that it was inflammatory. Okay. The judge made a ruling, and then he said, I don't know how I'm going to keep this out. And I believe that's how the record went. I mean,
isn't your best argument, despite everything else, that the court has the ultimate obligation to ensure the fairness of the trial?
And that's absolutely. The court must act as the gatekeeper, and that's their role. I mean, I believe Scharf says that.
Do you want to address the second issue briefly?
Sure. Just briefly as to the second issue, Your Honor. Lieutenant Caffone, who was the internal affairs investigator, it was argued on appeal that his testimony was impermissible lay opinion. I think that essentially what Caffone said was the police officers appeared criminal, or their conduct appeared criminal. His testimony is hard to ignore. It occurred over 2 days. The jury asked to see the videotapes. The jury's determination depended on deciding what events were or what version of events happened.
So assume you're right. Assume that the lieutenant was off base to make a comment and characterize what he saw as something that appeared to be criminal. Tell us how that harmed your client in the end, because you have your client's written statement in the administrative report saying this is what happened, and then you have a video that dramatically shows that's not what happened. Assume it's error. Is it harmless?
No, it's not. I mean, it's the concern is that he did not just say this is what happened on the videotape. He made a conclusion as to Trinidad's intent, and coming from a police officer on the stand saying that his conduct was criminal was extraordinarily important in this case, because there were two versions that they had to believe, or had to decide what is believable. And because of that, it can't be just shooed away. And that was the reason why it was capable of producing the unjust result.
So tell us why this overrides the evidence that comes forward in the dash cam video, which shows what actually happened. Why is the interpretive statement, and again, assume it's entirely wrong, important here?
Well, I mean, I don't know how a jury, I don't think we can say how a jury is going to interpret what the videotape depicts. We can hear what the lieutenant says it depicts, but to go further than that is like saying the hand-to-hand transaction was a drug deal.
What's the defense's view of the video?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What is the defense's view of the video? We have Lieutenant Caffone saying, I think there was a crime there.
Well,
what's your position? You've reviewed the video, right?
I'm sorry?
Have you reviewed the video?
I did not review the video, Your Honor. I mean, what I can say is I don't think that the video actually shows Trinidad.
How can you say if you didn't look at it?
Well, because it's transcript. I believe the transcript says that Trinidad isn't depicted in the video reaching inside the car.
But the video shows Mr. Jeter's head on the hood of the car quite clearly.
It does show that, Your Honor. That's after, that's after outside of the car.
Right,
correct.
But that's all part of
that's
the same.
That's correct.
You're not going to hear audio when someone's throwing a punch either. That's the reason why you have to look at the video.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the Court. I'd also like to talk about both of the issues before the Court. I'll leave it to my friends to my right to talk about many things with respect to point one, but I want to do two things. First, I want to take a stab at the 401 answer. Why is this relevant in the first place? And second, I want to respond to the Attorney General's reply brief, which calls for a very narrow reading. And then I want to get to Caffone. But so first on 401, I think I certainly hear the concerns about Jeter's state of mind not being an element, not being relevant. But to the extent that defense counsel sought to impugn the credibility of Jeter by highlighting the fact that he failed to get out of the car when ordered to do so, why he didn't get out of the car becomes relevant to his defense of his character, right? And so it might be a thin read. I certainly think 403 analysis is appropriate.
How far does that go? He's testifying that he's afraid.
Yes.
So that gives him the open door to identify any police brutality case that's gotten a lot of attention to say that's what was motivating me at that moment.
So as I was...
Is that the ACLU's position?
It isn't, Justice Levesque. As I was saying, I think 403 analysis is appropriate. You need to weigh. But I think to the point that there is no relevance, that's also a very extreme position to say your own subjective fears.
This is not a 1983 case.
Right, but once the defense makes an issue of the fact that he failed to get out, it becomes relevant in the case.
So if you had a...
But what are the elements of the offense here. Let's
concentrate. It doesn't go to an element. Okay? I can see that it doesn't go
whether
to
or not Jeter purposely or knowingly assaulted Trinidad, whether or not he happened to tamper with evidence, whether or not
Trinidad assaulted Jeter, but yes.
Jeter's state of mind getting out of the vehicle now, I was afraid to get out of the vehicle, and now he can name every sensational police misconduct case in the country?
So I think you're taking my argument further than I'm taking it, Justice Albin. To be clear on what I'm saying, when the defense says this is what, because look, I think the defense doesn't want to focus on the video. I've watched the video. We cite the video in our Lyndhurst brief. It's been in the public domain for years. The defense didn't want focus to be on that video or on those doctored reports. They wanted it to be on Marcus Jeter. So from their opening statement, they tried to deflect the focus from the elements of the offense, which weren't going to look very good to them, to Marcus Jeter and the ways in which he violated the law and he failed to abide by that. And so the state has the opportunity to try and rehabilitate their witness when they say, look, the reason he didn't get out of the car was a legitimate fear. Let me give you...
He could have said he was afraid. You know what you're not going to like, Mr. Shalom?
If the court
buys your argument, is that if Jeter is on trial and the police draw their handguns and they're approaching... And then there are questions like, why did you draw your handguns? Is when the police then say, because most police shootings occur when there's a stop of a motor vehicle. Their state of mind, which is just the reverse of what you're arguing. If we accept your argument, the police will have a legitimate basis for getting their state of mind, why they take certain actions, and bring in all the type of stuff that you typically rail against.
Except for the following, Justice Albin. They're already going to come and say, based on my training and experience, we draw our guns when we do it. They're already getting that out there, but let me be clear.
You want them to get at the fact that, yeah, because you know how many police shootings there were? That's the reason why I drew my gun. You want that out?
Justice Albin, to be clear, I think a 403 analysis is appropriate, and so the trial judge does need to weigh these things, weigh the prejudicial effect against the probative value. But to be clear, what I'm hearing defense counsel say is there is no probative value.
You're saying there is some grain of relevance.
Yes,
Where should the line be drawn in this case? There's on one hand the argument that Jeter shouldn't be allowed to say, I was scared. Another place to draw the line would be after that sentence and forbid him from commenting on specific potentially inflammatory cases. Where would you draw the line?
Before he says it, I think, to Justice Fernandez-Vina's point, I think once it's said, it's more difficult, then you need to deal with the limiting instruction or other remedies that are available to the judge. But that he was scared is certainly, I think, relevant and does not, would satisfy a 403 test. The specifics make it closer, but I think what they do is they give color to it in a way that is important for the jury to hear. Let me give you a few very quick examples. Imagine police came with a police dog and ordered someone out of the car. If it's relevant why the person doesn't get out of the car, the fact that they were mauled previously by a dog, everyone would say, well, that's relevant because it bears on their actual state of mind. If a woman was being pulled over on a rural street, dark rural...
That was a personal experience example.
I'm moving past
personal
experience.
Okay, let's get closer to the facts of this case.
Well, I think the progression is important because no one would argue with the dog.
Well, the first example that you're given, maybe there's relevance if the defendant is on trial. This is the police who are on trial. Of course, under those circumstances, and a motion to suppress or whatever, you seem to be like shifting back and forth your scenarios.
Justice Albin, to be clear, if you don't think that there's any relevance to Jeter's state of mind, then every argument I'm making with respect to the 403 analysis fails, because if there's no probative value...
I'm trying to figure out what scenario you're using when you're talking about the dog case. Is it that a case where the defendant is on trial?
Same thing. If you determine that the defense has raised why this witness didn't get out of the car, we've dealt with the dog, but I'm going to try and, to Justice LaVecchia's point, bring it closer to the facts here. A woman is pulled over by an unmarked car on a dark rural road. She calls 911 and says, I'm not going to pull over on this dark rural road because I'm afraid of being sexually assaulted, but I'm going to come to town half a mile ahead in the well-lit parking lot and I'll pull over there. No one would say, but wait, have you been sexually assaulted? Because we understand that that is a fear that is sufficiently pervasive.
You're not very close at this point to the actual fact.
Well, actually, I think I am. And this is...
Who's on trial in this scenario?
Everything, I'm talking about the same scenario. The police officer is on trial, but the police officer has raised, why didn't this person get out of the car? But I think Justice Patterson's critique of my example explains why you might need to get to the specifics. Because everyone accepts the idea that sexual assault is sufficiently pervasive as to cause fear for women, whether they've been the victim or not.
What if a sexual assault victim asked about why she did or didn't do something, starts rattling off famous sexual assault cases? There's no lack of them in the news these days. I read about this one, I read about that one, this victim was...
And so I don't think in that case it's necessary to provide the finders of fact, in this case the jury, with the relevant context. But to the extent that you think that the example I'm giving you is so far from the experience of a black person getting pulled over by police officers, where going through their mind, and we cite it to the social
science... There's nothing there about specific... The danger here, at least as I see it, is that the jury, presumably exposed to very highly publicized cases, has a view about those cases, may be accurate, may not be accurate, really almost doesn't matter. The facts of those cases are different. Whatever accuracy is really irrelevant, which suddenly is imported into this trial. And that's why I use the example of a sexual assault victim saying, wait a minute, I've been reading about all these cases, and this is why I didn't come forward, because I heard about the following five really inflammatory sexual assault cases that are in the news. You would be objecting to that very quickly.
I would, and I think there are ways in which the testimony given here could be objectionable. Let me step back and try.
Since the victim is not on trial here, wasn't it sufficient to say, I was scared to get out of the car and stop there? That's a reason for not getting out. He's not on trial. Why isn't that sufficient and stop there?
Perhaps it would be. I think that's going to be measured against the extent to which defense counsel is suggesting it's that his response was unreasonable, that Jeter's response was unreasonable. And if he says, I was scared, and we move on, that might be enough. But if they say, oh, how could you be scared? These are decorated Newark police officers or whatever, Bloomfield police officers. He could then it might be appropriate to get into this.
Why? They said it was unreasonable. Look, they were screaming. The police had guns, and they were telling the person to get out of the car. So that's one side of it. But the jury is there to determine whether or not Jeter assaulted the guy outside the car, whether or not he tampered with evidence. So all of that is like a side issue, and now the jury is charged with, hey, you can consider Jeter's state of mind, and the Diallo case, the Bell case, the Rodney King case, go back to the jury and talk all about it when you're considering Jeter's state of mind. You think the defendant can get a fair trial in that circumstance?
I do think the defendant can get a fair trial in that circumstance, because I think when a juror is called to a police misconduct case, it's on their mind too. But I'd like to move on and leave the rest to my friends, because I think the Caffone issue is actually a really big deal. And I also, when I'm done, I want to talk broadly about plain error and invited error, because I think it's important beyond this case. But so Caffone, the difference to me with the Caffone testimony from Jeter's testimony is that the Caffone testimony was totally out of, had nothing to do with a strategy of trial counsel for the defense, which is to say, we know that in their opening, trial counsel went after Jeter for not getting out of the car. Trial counsel didn't say, the internal affairs case in this case was closed. It was done. They were exonerated, and that should have been it. And then mysteriously, they decided to bring it back. So the state's response to why Caffone comes in is because he needed to explain why the case was reopened and why it was referred to the prosecutor's office. No, they didn't. That simply wasn't the case. This, to me, fits right into Branch, the Bankston line of cases that say you don't get to say on information received if no one accused you of acting arbitrarily or discriminatorily.
So would the better practice have been for counsel and the court to have worked out a sanitized statement to explain to the jury?
To the extent one is necessary at all, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you're kind of suggesting, Justice Levecchia, is their version of upon information received.
Exactly.
And I think the answer is yes, if you need it at all, because as Branch teaches, right? And Irving told, right, the kind of in repudiating Irving, Branch said, hold on, sometimes we don't need to say upon information received at all because it's not an issue why they put the photo in the array. And here, there was simply no reason for Caffone to tell us why the case was referred to the prosecutor's office. Defense counsel didn't make it an issue, and the state shouldn't have been allowed to at all. And that is really a thumb on the scale piece of evidence. I don't.
Why is it so important that it would be reversible error?
So, Justice Levecchia, that's a harder one for me because while I'm familiar with the video, I can't say I know every piece of evidence that came in. And
you're here as a friend of the court.
Exactly.
You're not weighing into the nice
to the harmless piece. But let me try and, Justice Albin, address your question of can invited error ever be plain? And I think the answer is yes, for the reason that you raised, which is ultimately if it impacts the fairness of the proceedings, the ultimate responsibility for that is with the trial court and then with this court.
Is there any difference between the two standards?
You know, that's a good question, Justice Patterson, and I have a hard time articulating it, but I think the answer is probably yes. Probably you have to surmount a little more when you invite it than when it's simply you failed to prevent it. I don't know how one articulates exactly what it is, but
in many cases that I've seen, invited error carries with it some seeming advantage to the person who's inviting the error. And I'm trying to think of what advantage the defense attorneys could conceivably have secured by bringing in sensational police brutality cases.
I'm not suggesting this was what was on their mind, and I have no idea what it was, but let me tell you one thing that came to my mind when I was thinking through that very question, the what were they thinking question, which is the violence in the cases that were referenced was horrific, right? Oscar Grant was murdered. Rodney King was beaten within a minute of his life. Sean Bell shot, right? These are, Amadou Diallo, right, also murdered. These are, and so if what they're trying to say is like, yeah, this is a police misconduct case, but it's not one of those police
misconduct. They didn't do that, though. Their argument was, oh, look at our police brutality case. Wasn't nearly as bad as those other cases. That was not a defense argument.
It may well have been bad lawyering, Justice Albin, but if you ask what conceivable advantage could they have gained, that's the only one that I was able to come up with. I think, but the other thing is to say that when, because clearly, I think the point the chief was getting to was this was really invited in the sense that the judge asked, Judge Raven said, hey, should we limit this? And defense counsel said, no, we can't limit it. That's an invitation. And so the question is, do we say the defendant has a higher mountain to climb, or a lower mountain to climb when defense counsel invites it in error really badly versus when they kind of invite it strategically? I think the point is there has to be some mechanism for a defendant to get relief from unfair error in his case, whether or not his attorney objected to it, and whether or even if his attorney.
But can really invited error apply where the judge made it so plain that he saw relevance, and therefore the only avenue left to go down was to limit damage through an instruction which the court was offering. No. So it seems as if the court really put defense counsel in a box here.
I think that's correct, Justice Levecchia. And I think what we sometimes have a hard time looking at when we're looking at cold transcripts is the strategy that comes from, you want to preserve the record on appeal, but defense counsel ultimately is not hoping to preserve the record for appeal. They're hoping to win.
Right.
And when the judge has said that the objection is overruled, for you to keep getting up and banging the drum makes you look obstreperous. It doesn't play well with the jury. So I think what you raised, Justice Levecchia, is a very important point, which is when the trial judge on any point has made clear that that she's going to rule one way or the other, that he's going to rule one way or the other, whatever, then it becomes the then it's out there. Then the objection has been raised, and we can't demand that defense counsel keep yelling and screaming and making a fuss.
You could go to sidebar, and the jury wouldn't hear all the yelling and screaming.
Even so, Justice Fernandez-Vina, there's still it's still distracting. It still slows down the flow of the case. And if they are going to go to sidebar, and then the judge is going to make a ruling on the record, And so when the judge says the objection is overruled, you're still sending the message to the jury that you are being, you're trying to distract from the point.
Can I raise one other thing? Because I thought I had it at the beginning and then I kind of lost it as the discussion went on. Are you arguing that even giving the state the benefit of the doubt and saying there is some relevance to bringing out the specific cases of police brutality, in this case, under 403, prejudice outweighs relevance?
That's not what I'm saying, Justice Allman. I'm saying that a 403 analysis was appropriate.
And?
Hard to say. I think...
Which way it comes out.
Correct. Okay. But I do think that ultimately there's enough relevance to get you past 401 and into 403.
Okay. But minimal relevance. You're not arguing this goes to the heart of the issues in the case.
Correct. I think in a case where, so let me just end with one kind of counterfactual, which is had Jeter been on trial and had his state of mind clearly been relevant, then I think there's a good chance that the actual specifics, the four or five specifics that he gave, would both be relevant and survive 403 analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Schlum. Ms. Roth.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Cases like this are among the most unfortunate. You have individuals who have been charged with protecting the community, brutally beating a young man, and then further violating that community's trust in their charge in writing false reports as a result of wanting to avoid the consequences. This case, with its overwhelming evidence, is ultimately about how people can't escape the consequences, no matter what their status in society. This court has no reason to do anything other than affirm defendants' convictions and consequences for his official misconduct in this case. Now, I'd like to engage in a little bit of housekeeping before I wade into the issues of point one, two, and I believe it's point three of my brief with Lieutenant Cofone. This court has already ruled to strike defendants' point 1B in his brief, and what remains outstanding are points 2 and points 4. I'll substantively address point 2 necessarily as part of point 1, I imagine. I'd like to briefly dispense with point 4 simply to say that real-time consequences are not an actual legal consideration when it comes to sentencing for a non-discretionary term. Official misconduct, which is truly the crux of the convictions here, is a five-year flat term. There's no discretion afforded to sentencing judges. It's either official misconduct in a five-year, and you can argue for a reduction, which defendant unsuccessfully did, or there's no consideration of real time. So in addition to the fact that real time was not brought up either in the trial court or in the appellate division, it's simply not applicable to this case. So I ask that this court completely dispense with defendant's point 4 on the sentencing issue. Moving on to point one, Justice Albin has sort of hit it on the head here that there is a standard of review issue. And I'd like to go through the chronology of how this all happened. I think it clarifies why plain error, reviewing for plain error is appropriate in this case and how exactly we got to this point. The state is looking for a narrow affirmance of defendant's convictions on this point. It's a unique case and it began in a unique way. Defense counsel opens, and I'd like to read verbatim from the opening, Trinidad's lawyer. So we have Trinidad and we have Quarter on trial in this case. Trinidad's lawyer ultimately raised the issue during his opening statement. He said, Mr. Jeter will have you believe the following. This is what he has told the world, and the reason I say the world is because after all this went down, Mr. Jeter gave an interview to Hot 97, the radio station, because he's a big-time celebrity now, basking in the afterglow. He continues to call Jeter a celebrity three more times during his opening statement. He tells the jury that's the story in his civil suit for big dollars. And Trinidad's lawyer, perhaps most offensively, described the assault as Jeter's big break. All of this sort of kicks off a defense theory of not just we're going to attack Jeter's credibility, but it also goes to the defense's factual theory of no, don't believe the victim, but also believe us when we say there are things that you don't see on the video that made us act the way that we did. So that's it has a more enhanced relevance than what we've been talking about earlier today, that it's sort of this two-prong defense theory that there's more to the story than meets the eye on the video, and here's why you shouldn't believe Jeter's rendition of what happened when we initially went to his house. Later on, during direct examination, the prosecutor had no choice but to ask the questions that the jurors were clearly wondering at this point. Why didn't you get out of the car, and why did you give the interview? Let's take these in turn because the analysis can look different for each one. I'd like to highlight when the prosecutor asked Jeter, why didn't you get out of the car, Trinidad's lawyer did not object at this time. So this suggests a plain error argument. Apparently, Trinidad's lawyer found this question acceptable and found Jeter's answer acceptable. Corder's lawyer objected at that time, but then withdrew the objection. He said he would renew if it happened again, but I believe he actually says he withdraws the question at this time. So that, again, suggests plain error. Neither defense counsel, by the time Jeter has already answered the question, why didn't you get out of the car, has an issue with Jeter's answer, notwithstanding his references to other police misconduct cases. Moving on to why did you give the interviews? Before Jeter could answer, Corder's lawyer, Trinidad's lawyer doesn't speak up yet, only Corder's lawyer objects at this time. And then there's the inquiry into, well, what is the relevance of Jeter's state of mind? The judge turns to Trinidad's lawyer and asks, well, didn't you open to this? And Trinidad's lawyer agrees, yes, I opened on Jeter's state of mind. I talked about how this is the break of his life, how this is essentially that the theory is Jeter planned this from the very beginning of the encounter back at Jeter's house, that he would become famous off of this interaction. So the trial judge advised that he would admit Jeter's answer and asked if there was any instruction that anyone wanted at the time. Both defense lawyers said no. Jeter then responded that he gave the interviews because he was mindful of these police misconduct cases, and the trial judge concluded that it was relevant to his state of mind that Trinidad's lawyer injected immediately into the case from the opening statement. Neither lawyer suggested a limiting instruction at this time, and Corder's lawyer explicitly opted to say, well, I'd like to cross-examine on this later. I'd like to compare and contrast what happened to Jeter to these other police misconduct cases, and I otherwise am fine with how we're resolving this. Again, this goes to the plain error argument. Everybody is accepting what has just happened and how the judge has resolved only Corder's lawyer's objection. The trial judge then asked, should I limit Jeter's testimony? Trinidad's lawyer said no because he was explaining his state of mind and he saw no reason to restrict Jeter in any way. Again, this goes to a plain error argument. Trinidad's lawyer is accepting that I've injected this into the case. It seems as though perhaps this will be dealt with on cross-examination, and they're getting to, at least the defense seems to think they're moving the ball more closer to where they want it to go to accord with their defense theory. Jeter went on to explain why he gave the interviews, that he was a victim of police misconduct like the other cases, and at the end of his explanation, there is no objection from either defense lawyer. Then later on cross-examination, Corder's lawyer asked a few questions of Jeter about these other cases, and, you know, essentially having had the chance to review the video could compare and contrast for themselves the different degrees of brutality between the assaults and the other police misconduct cases. So with respect to the reference to the other cases and with respect to the limiting instruction, if this court does choose to get into the substantive merits of this dilatory argument that defendant raises for the first time in this court, it seems to be that the defense lawyers agreed with how the court handled it, that how the court handled it, allowing them to have a limiting instruction that ultimately the judge, just as I believe Justice Alvin noted, the defense lawyer suggested an instruction and the judge essentially read the instruction that the defense lawyer had written or had suggested. So it seems to be that this is truly a plain error case. Now the question remains, does this constitute plain error? And this goes to the state's point five, which is the overwhelming evidence of this case. As far as the elements of this case go, all that really matters is a comparison between what happened in the video and what the jurors could see in the two dash cam videos, because together they tell the complete story of what happened. Corder's dash cam video gives the view of behind Jeter's car, and then Trinidad's dash cam video gives the view of in front of Jeter's car. Between the two, you can see everything that transpired. And you can see when you watch those videos that Jeter did not reach for Corder's gun, that Jeter was not aggressing against any of the officers. And everything that is set forth in the IA reports and the statements given by the officers and the arrest report of Marcus Jeter indicates that they lied in their official reports in the internal affairs investigation and in the original arrest report.
Okay, so your position, it seems to be that based upon the video, it's overwhelming evidence, even if there was error. I want to go to the opening statement that you said. And it's true the defense attorney said that this was Jeter's big break, because all the charges were dismissed and they filed a civil suit. Now, all the charges being dismissed would be relevant on cross-examination of Jeter, correct?
That would be correct.
Whether he filed a civil suit against the police officers, that would be relevant, too.
They're entitled to talk about it, and they did.
So I'm not suggesting that they should have pressed this argument, he had a big break, but it was still touching on things that were relevant. How does that justify, even from the opening, Jeter being able to talk about the most sensational and inflammatory police brutality cases in the nation?
In this sense, and this is where I emphasize we're looking for a narrow affirmance here, generally the sorts of references he made would be inappropriate. But we're viewing this through the lens of plain error, not through abuse of discretion. We're viewing it through plain error because of the defense theories and sort of the sub-theories that defense lawyers...
So wait, you concede it's error? You just conceded that it was error to have made those statements?
It's inappropriate, and I believe in this very narrow case, it was just on the side of it was acceptable in light of the overwhelming evidence.
Even Mr. Simon, what's interesting, and I actually credit the assistant prosecutor because when the first mention was made about Amado Diallo's, the prosecutor was the one who said, I can certainly understand the inflammatory aspect. That's not where I was going. He was trying to basically excuse the fact that this had popped out of the witness's mouth. And it was the judge then who really gets going with this state of mind. Well, there's a question here, what was in the man's state of mind? And that seems to be basically the opening for this whole state of mind that later infuses the entire trial. Do you agree?
I believe it starts with the opening statement, that's where the state of mind is injected, because it seems, even when you look at Corder's testimony about what happened at Jeter's house, it seems to be there's a different story about what happened at Jeter's house. Don't believe Jeter's version of the story, believe my version.
No, but so the part that I just quoted, mm-hmm. It's in the part of the transcript. God bless you.
Thank you.
God bless the court.
Indeed, Your Honor.
The court thanks you.
When he makes that comment, it is when Jeter is testifying about what happened in the car. So the state of mind in the context on page 56 of the transcript has nothing to do with the opening statement. It has to do with the events on the parkway. Do you agree?
I disagree. I believe that my reading of the defense's factual theory, looking at the opening statement and then how the different lawyers direct examined.
I'm looking at page 55 of the transcript, which precedes 56. This is Jeter. Mm-hmm. My phone. I actually dropped my phone in the cup holder when I saw him. When I saw the gun, I dropped the phone in the cup holder. ... You know, you hear stories of the Amado Diallos and stuff where, and Clark objects, and then we have the sidebar.
Right.
And that's where then Mr. Simon, the prosecutor, says, well, I think...
This is spontaneous and...
Yes. This has nothing, I mean, this introduction has nothing to do with the opening statement. Do you agree? When the first Amado Diallo is mentioned and when the judge is talking about state of mind, it is Jeter's state of mind in the car. Do you have the transcript?
Not with me, Your Honor. I remember the part that you're talking about, and I would say that with the opening statement, it's not just about the interview.
I'm talking about this part, when the judge talks about the state of mind of Jeter. He's talking about his state of mind in the car, because that's the context in the transcript when during Jeter's testimony. Jeter's talking about what he was doing in the car when this all comes up.
I believe that's part and parcel of the what was going on in his mind the entire time. What was going on in his mind when he left his car? What was going on in his mind when he was pulled over? And there's some degree of insinuation in the opening statement about why didn't Jeter get out of the car? He saw an opportunity, which is an absurd argument to make, but that seems to be the argument being made by the defense.
It's a stretch,
not
isn't it?
Answering
that's
the question.
That's a bit of a stretch.
Let's try it this way. Surely looking at Rule 401, place 403 to the side. When asked, why didn't you get out of the car? One can fashion an argument, I was scared, I was thinking about all these other notorious cases, that's why I didn't get out of the car. How is it relevant in response to the fame and fortune argument that you get into specific cases of police misconduct?
It goes to the overall defense theory of Jeter's not credible from the very beginning, and based on this theory, there could be some questions of did he calculate all of this from the beginning, that he would refuse to get out of the car on the chance that this might become an infamous case.
So he's more credible because Sean Bell was the victim of police misconduct and Rodney King, Amadou Diallo, you think that's a legitimate argument? For saying Jeter's more credible because other people have been victims of police misconduct?
It explains why he didn't get out of the car. Now, the mentioning of this...
Now we're talking about the opening statement.
Right.
Because you were talking about, his credibility in giving the interview. It makes him more credible because, Rodney King was beaten and Sean Bell was a victim and Amadou Diallo was shot. I'm trying to understand the logic of this.
It's that defense counsel essentially challenged, we don't believe Jeter's version of the story, that he has calculated his version of the story from how he describes how...
So Jeter is more credible because Rodney King was beaten by the L.A. police? Is that the argument the state's making?
No, it's that it explains why he acted as he did, at least when he was asked, why didn't you get out of the car? He was thinking of these cases. Should he have mentioned these cases by name? Perhaps not. But this case, this trial was ultimately about official misconduct.
Your theory would be that the police officers seem to be suggesting maybe he had a weapon,
yes,
and that his sitting in the car and refusing to get out might have been an effort. This is the possible theory, that the possible defense theory, that they were concerned there was a weapon there. And this alternative explanation, which is that he was afraid because he knew about these other cases, refutes that theory.
Yes, that's essentially.
What principle would you advance for these kinds of cases in the future when it comes to this sort of arguably inflammatory evidence?
Generally, neither victims nor no party should be specifically mentioning cases by name. In this specific case, because of how these arguments unfolded in the trial court and based on the different concessions made by the defense lawyers and their stated theory from the very beginning, this is truly a plain error situation. This isn't certainly something we want replicated in future cases. The state specifically is not looking for some new rule of evidence wherein the victim can refer to other high-profile cases. That's certainly not what the state is advancing here. The state is advancing, leave the rules of evidence as they are. Do not use the rules of evidence to advance any public policy concerns or to respond to things that are that people see in the media. The state is just asking, review for plain error. And here, the mere references to other police misconduct cases that surely the jurors are already aware of and are mindful of doesn't outweigh the fact that that this is a cover-up case at its heart. Sure, of course, Trinidad's also convicted of the simple assault that's plainly caught on camera at the very end of Quarter's dash cam video when he punches Jeter to the back of the head. It's hard to overcome that evidence.
Jeter was a defendant at some time.
He was.
Would it have been permissible in the criminal, had you proceeded with the criminal case against Jeter, for Jeter to mention that the reason why I didn't get out was because of the Rodney King and the Sean Bell cases?
No, it would not have been permissible. Here, just through the lens
of the claim. And that's one of the reasons why you seem to be conceding that specific mention of these names is not a really good thing.
No, it's not. It's inappropriate, Your Honor. But it's not quite, but it doesn't outweigh the fact that we have a very rare
So where are you on the issue of 401? Was it error to admit this? Now you're talking about plain error, didn't change the result, but was it error, and this is an issue that goes forward to other cases, mm-hmm. for the court to permit the victim to testify about notorious cases?
It was error, but it wasn't plain error. It was not enough to create an unjust result in the case because we have the rare luxury of having the two dash cam videos and then the opportunity to compare them to the falsified arrests and internal investigation reports.
Just one last question, Chief. Does the plain error analysis change at all in by the fact that the first time it comes up with the judge and the question about whether the case should be named at all is on one day of trial? The objection and relevance is put right before the court, and yet continued references made by the witness, adding more cases on 5 days later when they're resuming the trial, and the court has never given an instruction to the witness to not name specific cases in his testimony.
Based on the prosecutor's response to the first time that he mentions the specific cases, as Justice Albin observed, he seemed to acknowledge that it was inappropriate and it was inflammatory. I won't speak for the prosecutor, but I'm sure that he discussed with the witness not a good idea going forward.
But was it plain error for the court not to have handled the situation better?
No, it wasn't. The court was relying on
the court was the only one was in the position to say you can talk about being frightened, but you cannot name those cases. It was raised for the first time on October 15th, addressed on the point of relevance and in being inflammatory, and yet the court permitted it not only that day but also on the 20th.
Well, on the 20th, it was a little different. So both defense lawyers objected, and then the trial court suggested the limiting instruction.
But not the limiting instruction to keep the name of those other cases from the jury.
To explain to the jury how they should use the evidence, to remind them that it's narrowly for the state.
But if it was error for it to come in, the judge is now multiplying the error by telling the jury, you know, you actually can consider it for a purpose that you're conceding was erroneous. If it can't come in for state of mind, now they're back in the jury room talking about Rodney King and Sean Bell.
I think the judge did the best that he could under those circumstances. I think based on the prosecutor's representations, I believe from the day before, I think it was surprising that Jeter again went down this road, that it was again a sort of spontaneous utterance from Jeter.
It didn't seem so spontaneous. It seemed as if it was the witness had clearly in mind what testimony he wanted to give, because he kept referring to it as the testimony that he wanted to present. What happened to him? That happened to him.
I read that a little differently, Your Honor. I read that, I think when he refers to testimony, and this is my testimony, he mentions before that he's talking about going to church. I think he's talking about it somewhat in a more spiritual sense, that this is something that happened to me that I want to share with the world.
Right.
So I don't think he's meaning testimony in the way we all talk about testimony. I think he's talking about it in perhaps a more...
He's saying that after having specifically mentioned now four cases, he said, that's what happened to me.
Unfortunately, witnesses don't always give the answers that we believe that they're going to give. Witnesses sometimes add a little more once they're on the stand. I speak from personal experience.
But the fact that the court never nipped in the bud the references to other cases just kept becoming exacerbated with each addition that was made by the witness. That's my point. And does that factor into the plain error analysis?
It might have been better if the court had, but again, the proofs in this case are so strong that it doesn't overcome the standard of plain error.
Okay, I understand.
Let's go on to Lieutenant Cafone's comment.
Yes.
That what he saw in the video, quote, appeared to have been criminal. Appropriate testimony? What's the state's position on that?
This sort of passing comment, first of all, I'd like to reiterate again, this is a plain, this is reviewing for plain error.
Was
there was
it,
no
was
objection. To admit it, no, it wasn't. He had previously explained during direct examination how the internal affairs procedures take place in New Jersey, and in fact, he was just explaining how this comported with the Attorney General instruction, the guidelines on how to conduct internal affairs cases. That
would it have been appropriate for a prosecutor to put the question directly and say, you saw the video, did it appear criminal to you?
That would have been asking for an actual opinion. This appeared criminal wasn't an opinion so much as an explanation for why he passed the case along to the prosecutor's office. Because
how was that relevant? Who cares that they passed it along to the prosecutor's office? The question is whether or not Trinidad committed an assault. So under what this need to pass along to the prosecutor's office, you're permitted to get in an opinion by the lieutenant that his review of the video led him to conclude that it was criminal?
It wasn't offered as an opinion. He was explaining earlier in his direct examination, he explains the procedures that take place during an internal affairs procedure. And during that procedure, it's very clear the question of whether something is in fact criminal is not for the internal affairs detective to decide. The internal affairs detective brings it to the prosecutors, who then decide whether it's criminal. So
the officer could have simply said, I viewed the video, I forwarded it to the prosecutor's office. It's that middle part that's problematic. Why is that not error?
It's problematic, but it's not error because it explains, there was some back and forth about what happened to the second video. So naturally there are going to be questions from the jury. Why was the internal affairs investigation closed earlier, and then why was it being reopened? And if there was something on the video that didn't raise any questions to Lieutenant Cofone, he wouldn't have passed it on to the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. So naturally there's a question of why did you reopen and why did you pass?
Because his opinion was that something criminal occurred. Is that proper? It is an opinion. Not in any way you slice it, this is an opinion by Cofone that what he saw appeared criminal, which the jury heard from someone experienced in law enforcement who was investigating. Any way you slice it, it's an opinion as to the ultimate issue of whether a crime was committed or
not. I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. He didn't say that this was in fact criminal. He did not say that he would have charged it himself if he were one of the prosecutors. He did not say that he recommended indicting on it or presenting it to a grand jury. He simply said there was something that appeared wrong with what I saw in the video, and to comport with the internal affairs.
But you didn't say criminal. You said appeared wrong to us.
Appeared wrong.
You avoided the word appeared criminal when you answered your question.
Right. Could it have been better phrased? Absolutely.
This is like Mr. Shlom brought out the branch issue. Mm-hmm. When the police put a photograph in an array, the jury doesn't need to know why it was placed in the array. And it's inappropriate to say, I put that photograph in the array because he was a suspect. Okay, suggesting that the police officer had reason to believe they may have engaged in criminal activity. That's the same thing going on here. That's what Mr. Shlom is saying, is that the police internal affairs officer is putting his finger on the scale in saying that video that you're about to watch is criminal. That's what I found it. I looked at it, and I thought it was criminal.
Well, even if it is error to have said it appeared criminal, when you watch the video, it certainly does appear criminal to see somebody punch a handcuffed man in the back of the head. And then it certainly does appear to be criminal when you watch the dash cam videos, the two of them together, and then review the internal investigation affairs.
But that's not okay. It's not okay for the witness to come to that conclusion. That conclusion is left for the jury. Do you agree?
It is left to the jury, and the jury had an overwhelming amount of evidence to agree with Lieutenant Cofone.
But to be clear, you're not conceding that it was error.
It was inappropriate, but again, this case is unique in that the jury could watch the video themselves, the jury could look and compare to the reports themselves, and everything that they would see would certainly appear criminal, even to their untrained eye. It would not unjustly alter the outcome of this case simply because of two words Lieutenant Cofone said.
Would you concede that the right thing for the court to do right at that moment was to just strike the answer and instruct the jury to disregard it?
I think there should have been some opportunity for Lieutenant Cofone to still explain why he passed along the case, but perhaps there could have been an instruction saying, you know, narrowly striking the appeared criminal part or giving the state the opportunity to let Lieutenant Cofone phrase differently.
Anything else you'd like to present?
Other than simply, Your Honors, viewing this case through the lens of plain error, none of these missteps in the witness testimony overcome the fact that the jury had a rare opportunity to view the two dash cam videos, see what actually happened, and the crux of most of the crimes of which Trinidad was convicted is truly the cover-up. And they have the opportunity to look at the videos, to look at the reports, and see that the reports were utterly falsified. Nothing any witness could have said, any passing comments, any utterances, could not have outweighed the fact that this is a cover-up crime at the end of the day, and the jury could see plainly that the officers attempted to cover up what they had done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McGuire.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Most of the points that I'm here to make today have been discussed at length, so I'm going to keep my comments very brief. It's our position that in cases such as this involving police brutality, it's absolutely essential when the victim has their motives called into question that they be given an opportunity to explain their actions or lack thereof. In this case, you know, aside from the defense opening calling his credibility into question, there was also evidence that during the stop on the parkway, Mr. Corder was given permission from dispatch to use whatever force necessary as Mr. Jeter sat locked in his car. And so at that point, it became necessary for the state to essentially rehabilitate his credibility. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point to is the model jury instruction for credibility. You know, one of the factors that the jury is instructed to consider is the reasonableness or unreasonableness of the testimony. And in that regard, this was particularly relevant. Now, in most cases, I would concede that a victim's state of mind is not an issue before the jury, but this court has observed in State v. Sharp that when the victim's state of mind is called into question, that it opens the door to that type of testimony. And we submit that that's exactly what happened in this case.
Sharp was an entirely different situation. That was a deceased wife, and they were getting in her actions and understandings prior to being killed.
Actually, it was very much distinguishable, but I think the reasoning behind it is that when the defense calls a victim's credibility or motive into question, that it's then appropriate at that point to rebut that.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case. Sharp wasn't about her credibility and motives. It was about
An affirmative defense raised by the defendant. In this case, I would submit that there was essentially a justification defense raised.
Do you have a case really that dealt with the credibility type? With the issue that is involved here?
I don't have one that's directly on point, Justice, but really what this comes down to is Mr. Jeter's credibility was, in fact, impugned by the defense.
Going back to the example I asked your co-counsel about, if a sexual assault victim's credibility is challenged, can she or he then cite famous cases that in which the sexual assault victims have been either somehow disadvantaged in terms of their careers or further brutalized as a result of their statements, et cetera. Is that okay?
I think that's a very difficult argument for me to stand here and make. There's certainly an inherently prejudicial aspect of naming individual cases, and that's understood. You know, perhaps the best way to do this would have been to have a 104 hearing to see what he was going to testify to and limit it before he took the stand before the jury. But with that being said, I think, you know, it's very difficult for people to divorce their understandings from the media, whether it's in person, through news, It's very difficult for someone to separate that from their state of mind.
Sure, victims may have that difficulty, and that's where the role of the court is so important in guiding the proceedings so that the victim isn't simply testifying about what she or he, whatever comes into their minds, with some guidance from the court.
I would agree with that, Justice, and you know, I think the trial court in this case did the best that he could with the circumstances that were presented. I think limiting the testimony to Mr. Jeter's state of mind was the right result in this case.
In your brief, you advance a number of arguments about people of color in this situation being allowed to testify about their state of mind. Is your argument more broadly directed toward victims generally?
It is, Justice. In this case particularly, you know, Mr. Jeter being a person of color and perhaps having jurors who don't have the same life experiences as him and may have a very much different view of police officers and their interactions with law enforcement officers, you know, I think it's important for him to have that opportunity to explain why he didn't get out of the car.
But that would be one thing if Jeter were on trial for the charges originally filed against him, because he was obstruction, eluding, everything else. But here the state of minds at issue before the jury is Trinidad's, whether he purposely and knowingly assaulted him outside of the car, not inside the car, and whether or not he falsified information.
Well, I think part of the evidence in the case was whether he was justified in using that force.
So I'm trying to figure out how Jeter's state of mind gets in here with all this inflammatory information when the jury is supposed to be determining Trinidad's state of mind.
Well, I think that goes back to the opening statement, Justice, and I know the court has concerns with how far he went in responding to defense counsel's opening. I think that, you know, in other circumstances, a 104 hearing would be appropriate for his testimony. But that being said, this was organic. It came out during questioning. The prosecutor didn't expect it, and they dealt with it on their feet the best they could under the circumstances. Now, I think his state of mind was in question, and the jury has to make a credibility determination.
So are you going to be okay when Jeter or some similarly situated defendant is on trial for a motor vehicle stop and the police officer wants to get out before the jury his state of mind, why he pulled his gun, why he took a baton and smashed in the window, because there have been a number of police officers shot during police stops? You going to be okay with that?
Well, I think to Mr. Shalom's point, that often comes in, maybe not the last part as to other officers being shot.
Well, the specifics, because the specifics came here with other cases. Police officers bring in other cases. You know, there were 15 other police shootings on the parkway. You want to know why I pulled out my gun? You going to be okay with that when a criminal defendant is on trial?
I think it's somewhat distinguishable, Justice, because in this case, I think...
In what way? They're both defendants in a criminal case.
They are defendants.
How is it distinguishable?
Well, I think in this case, what Mr. Jeter's testimony was is not that, you know, this was an Amadou Diallo case. This was another high-profile Rodney King case. It was more along the lines of, I remember seeing these types of cases, and that's why I was fearful.
And the police officers say, not only do I remember seeing them, I've read them. It's part of our training. So why wouldn't that be okay then?
Well, and again, I think part of our argument is that it would have been better not to mention the specific cases. But to his general understanding that we see these types of cases in the media, perhaps that would have been a better way to phrase it. But we're asking victims testifying under intense stress to self-censor themselves, which is a difficult...
To self-censor themselves, or something?
Right.
No, the court's there for that.
Yeah.
The court's there to take care of that. But it... Yes?
Yes, that's
not
correct.
Not the witness. We recognize that people are human.
Right.
Even we're human, sort of, kind of.
Well, you know, and I think, you know, the trial court did attempt to do that. He did suggest, are we going to limit this... Are we going to limit this testimony? And defense counsel did, in fact, say, you know, I don't know how we can limit his state of mind. And
once
he conceded that he didn't.
Once the court said it's relevant, as you're arguing, it's relevant.
I think it certainly is relevant.
Anything else you'd like to add?
That's it, unless there's any questions.
Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Geis, brief rebuttal?
No, I think I'm fine, unless there
are any
questions you can take.
Very good. We'll take the matter under advisement. Anyone need a break?